Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by United Way. Whether it's helping a single mom in Dundalk keep her home or giving a bright student in Sandtown a chance to be his best, United Way fights for families. Help them win the fight. Visit uwcm.org/fight.
Hello again, everyone. Dan Rodericks here from the Baltimore Sun with the Roughly Speaking podcast, and it's episode 442 now. We're really getting up there. The show has been produced for the last 3 years now, and thank you again for tuning in. This is a pre-Thanksgiving Home for the Holidays holiday entertaining special with some excerpts from earlier episodes. Brendan Dorr, the bartender at the B&O American Brasserie down in Baltimore at Charles Street, he's going to talk to us about what you need for the good home bar. And I don't mean the booze, I mean what kind of glasses you should have for different cocktails if you're going to mix cocktails for your guests. And then Kevin Addicks is going to come along. He's the executive director of the Maryland Wineries Association. And if you recall, about a year ago, Kevin was on the show to talk about all 70 Maryland wineries. He talked a little bit, a few minutes, about every one of them. And at the end of the show, I asked him, you know, what does he do for wine at Thanksgiving? So Kevin Addicks, executive director of the Maryland Wineries Association, will be with us just for a couple of minutes to talk about what he does at Thanksgiving in terms of wine with Thanksgiving dinner. And then speaking of dinner, John Shields, our friend from Gertrude's Restaurant in the Baltimore Museum of Art, we pay him a visit, we go to the kitchen of Gertrude's, and we'll get from John a few tips about Thanksgiving dinner. So if you haven't put together the whole menu yet and you're looking for some ideas, John Shields has some for you, and there's some really good ones, and you can find more information about all of this in the notes of the podcast. Okay, let's get on with the show. We're going to start with Brendan Dorr, just to talk a little bit about some of the glasses you should have if you don't have them already for your home bar, and then Kevin Addicks on wine, John Shields with some tips on Thanksgiving dinner. If you want to put out some cocktails for folks, actually make some nice cocktails, Brendan's going to tell you what you need for the properly stocked home bar. And you don't mean just booze, you mean glasses.
Absolutely. It is holiday season. It's time to entertain. And it also gives a good opportunity that if you need to give a gift to somebody, some bar tools or spirits could make for a very nice gift to somebody who is an avid bartender at their house or looking to become a bar enthusiast at home.
Let's start with the glasses. So what kind of glasses should you have for a good variety of cocktails?
Exactly. So you just said it, a good variety. That is what you need, is a good variety. You should have a highball or a Collins glass, something tall and elegant. It doesn't
tall and cylindrical.
Tall, cylindrical. Oh, exactly.
I'm pointing to it. This is podcast, sort of like radio. We have to tell people what we're doing. So exactly. I'm now pointing to a tall, cylindrical Tom Collins or highball glass.
Exactly. So a Tom Collins, a highball, you know, something tall, cylindrical, easy cocktail. Yes, a very simple glass. So next on your list should be a standard rocks glass. Something around 10 to 12 ounces will do. Some people like bigger rocks glasses.
Question, excuse me. I call that a tumbler. What are you calling it?
We call it a rocks glass. It also gets called a lowball, but also a tumbler. So it comes in multiple names. I feel like sometimes tumblers have a bit more of a convex kind of angle on it. So they open up a little bit, you know, on a slight angle. But, you know, anything that is a short, once again, cylindrical glass, you can do old fashions, Sazeracs. If you like your Manhattan on the rocks, if you like, you know, cocktails that are typically up on the rocks, or just you feel that's a little more sturdy glass for your hand, that's a really good all-purpose, you know, working glass.
Is that a good Negroni glass?
That is a perfect Negroni glass, or Boulevardier for that fact.
Boulevardier. Okay, so, Brendan, what else do you have in it? Now, this looks like cordial glass. How do we describe that? It has a stem and...
It looks like a short wine glass. That kind of has the top chopped off of it. Yeah. It doesn't curve back in. So this is actually called a Nick and Nora glass, made famous from the Thin Man movie series of Nick and Nora.
Say, how many drinks have you had?
This will make 6 martinis.
All right. Will you bring me 5 more martinis? Leon, line them right up here.
Yes, ma'am.
And so this is the glass that they like to drink out of. So the cocktail glass itself was popularized by the movie, much like the martini glass, really a cocktail glass, was popularized by the cocktail of the martini.
What do you use that for?
So these glasses, so I also next to it have a coupe, which traditionally was used for like champagne. But nowadays, bartenders, we love them for cocktails, egg white cocktails. They look beautiful in, you know, just this is a little broader, a little more of like a saucer style glass. But either one of these could work great for your just single at home. You want to serve a cocktail up. You don't want it in the tumbler, the lowball, the rocks glass. You don't want it in a Collins. You're looking to present it a little more elegantly. Just a stemmed glass. The martini glass works great, but I prefer something that has a little bit of roundness to it. It also makes it, when you've had a few of these, it makes it a little less easy to slosh everywhere, where the martini glass loves to let you spill your tasty cocktail on your friend's shiny shoes.
Neither of those, Nick and Nora, nor the Coupe, look like you want to put ice in those. So you're right. Those are for straight-up cocktails. I could see a Manhattan in one of them. Now, this little guy here, this almost looks like a votive candle glass. But
you know,
what is that?
So this is something if you're starting to, you want to increase your glassware at home. This is a whiskey glass called a Glencairn glass. So Glencairn is a Scotch whiskey.
Is he working on a case?
Yes.
What
yes.
case?
A case of Scotch.
And they developed a glass used, you know, with experts probably from like Riddell and from other whiskey experts to develop a glass that just puts the right amount of air and directs the aromatics the correct way. So it has kind of like a tulip shape. Right? It's got that kind of flower. It comes out and then gets very...
Tulip shape is a better description than what I gave you.
Yeah.
It looks like it would direct the aromatics where they belong, right?
Exactly.
Up your nose.
Up your nose, exactly. Doesn't put too much air in, so you don't get a big waft of alcohol in your nose. Just puts those aromatics right where you want. So this is a nice glass to up your glass at-home glassware collection.
Okay, we've gone through all the glass. Let's move on to aromatics.
Yeah, the aromatics. The three bitters that I recommend for any home bartender to definitely have is one, Angostura. I mean, it is the godfather of bitters. It is one of the oldest bitters. It is probably the oldest bitters out there that has not ceased to exist. Even, you know, some have made a resurgence, but this one has stayed true. It has stayed in bars. It is a classic aromatic bitter that is in many cocktails.
You have two others you recommend.
Next down the line is Peychaud's. This one made a resurgence because people started learning about one of the oldest cocktails, the Sazerac. This is from New Orleans. It kind of has a cherry and anise kind of note to it, but you can't make a Sazerac without without Peychaud bitters. And then last, orange bitters. Orange bitters, you see them a lot in a lot of old-time cocktails, and just another bar essential. I mean, there are a plethora of wonderful bitters out there. There are shops dedicated to bitters where they have over 100 different offerings you can buy, but these are the three that I would recommend. I think Angostura, Peychaud's, and a type of orange bitters. I personally like Bitter Truth. There's Fee Brothers out there. I find Fee Brothers a bit sweet for my own personal taste because they use glycerin, not alcohol. So it does change it will change the flavor of your cocktail. It won't add that bitter. It'll definitely add orange, but not quite bitter. But Fee Brothers, I will give them credit. They were one of the first orange bitters out on the market when bitters really started making a resurgence.
That was Brendan Doerr, president of the Baltimore Bartenders Guild and chief bartender at the B&O American Brasserie at Baltimore and Charles Street. Stay with us, a short break, a message from a sponsor, and then Kevin Addicks, executive director of the Maryland Wineries Association, with a couple of tips about wine at Thanksgiving.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rogics is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at 6080 Falls Road, located at the intersection of Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. More information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.
What type of wine do you like with Thanksgiving dinner, with turkey and all the trimmings? You don't have to give me a brand, but what type of wine? Yeah,
I tend to get confused around Thanksgiving, and the typical advice is a red blend that can match all the different flavors.
Yeah.
And something that's different and unique on the white side, like a Gewürztraminer, because you're trying to stand out. If you think of a traditional Thanksgiving meal, there's no hope. You're not going to find one wine to pair with
it. It's perfect with everything.
So, so I go the different route, and my wife and family are amused by it. But when it comes time for Thanksgiving dinner, there will be 8 bottles of wine out. And you know, I just open it up. Anybody who wants to try anything with anything, go for it.
Yeah.
My favorites, Cabernet Franc, Sangiovese.
Yeah. I like cabs with turkey dinner for some reason. I don't know. I got hooked on that years ago.
Go for it.
It made sense to me. Well, thank you very much for doing this, Kevin. And I mentioned before, touring, visiting these places around, you'd see a lot of Maryland, and you'd visit some really pretty places and sip some nice wine, too.
Hope to see you on the wine trail.
Thank you.
All right, some quickie tips there from Kevin Addix of the Maryland Wineries Association. By the way, if you want to hear that episode that we did with Kevin last year, it's episode 327, a podcast tour of all 70 Maryland wineries if you're planning to get out on the Maryland Wine Trail in the year ahead. Okay, a short break, a couple of messages from our wonderful sponsors, and then John Shields will be at Gertrude's Restaurant with him, and he has a few pointers for Thanksgiving dinner.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by United Way. From housing and education to healthcare and employment, they will help you fight to make the biggest difference in your community. Join the fight at uwcm.org/fight.
To convince everybody that we're actually in this kitchen, we need to make some noise.
Yolanda, could you chop real loud for us?
Yolanda, what's Yolanda chopping? Some onions? What are you making?
Oyster stew.
What else goes into the oyster stew?
Celery, a little bit of cayenne, cream and milk.
That's it?
Bacon fat.
Bacon fat. If I stand here long enough, we'll get all the ingredients. So I think people are convinced now that we are in the kitchen. Can we go down here where it's really hot? What's going on down here, John?
Pedro's over here. He's making a butter sauce, a shallot butter sauce.
Hola, Pedro.
Hola.
Ooh, that looks good. Shallot and butter sauce for what?
We usually use it for a number of the fish, some of the salmon dishes. You can top it. So you're basically taking white wine and shallots, all kinds of herbs, a little vinegar, reducing it way down. And as you can see, he's swirling in a ton of butter at this point.
That is beautiful. It smells so good, too. Yeah. And is that a enameled cast iron?
It is. It is. You know, whenever you're making kind of like a beurre blanc or something butter like that, it's best to use the enamel one. It heats better, and it also doesn't react with the metal. So it's good.
Very nice. Do you mind clattering some pans or pots, just so people understand that we're actually still in Gertrude's kitchen? Thank you, Pedro. Gracias. And what's inside the giant pot?
This is Yolanda. She's starting her Maryland crab soup.
What are we looking at? I see tomatoes. I see celery.
Celery. And then she's got you know how she always has something secret here? Let's pull this.
Yolanda always has something secret in the pot?
Oh, my God.
John, what is that?
She's got...
What are you trying to pull out of there?
Ham hocks. She's got all kinds of bones that she flavors the stock while she's making it.
Is that authorized? You seem surprised to find that in there.
Well, it was just heavier than I thought.
That is a big piece of ham.
That's a big thing. God knows what she found, but it's in there.
Oh, wow. So there's a little tip for someone making crab soup.
It is.
For your stock, use smoked ham?
Smoked ham or a little ham hock. I got that from Miss Jean Chigoris down at Nick's Inner Harbor Seafood.
Oh, Tommy's mom.
Tommy's mom, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, so this is Miss Jean's crab soup. Right there.
Working further down the galley here, that we come to the French fries, all hand cut.
Hand cut, and they're blanched.
Wait a minute, hand cut or hands on a machine that cut them?
Hand cut on a machine.
Hand cut on a machine.
And then Manas is blanching it in the oil here. So the oil's like a lower temperature than you would usually fry at. Normally, you're going to be frying at about 375, but we take it down to about 275, 300 degrees. You blanch them for a little bit, put them on a sheet tray, and then we chill them. And then when you're ready, when it's time for the
Finish.
It'll be up at about 375. You put them in there and boom. And that's what makes them really crisp. The blanching is really important. And you can also see here, Manasse has this thing.
Let me describe this. It's a big white plastic barrel with a liquid inside.
Yeah, so
it's sort of a dingy liquid. But John just put his hand in it. And what are you reaching for, John?
Just a little the French fries, because he puts them in there. It washes off the starch.
What is that?
Water.
It's just water.
Just water. And then you take, after you do that, you take and you dry them a little bit before you actually blanch them. So
that's an interesting process.
Cut them, wash them, blanch them, and then when you're ready to go, fry them.
I think people who do French fries well, meaning the French,
yeah,
they know this, that you fry them twice.
You have to.
And your process is really interesting. What kind of potato do you use for French fries?
Right now we're using a #2 Idaho potato.
The #2 Idaho, one of my favorites. John Shields actually put together a whole menu for Thanksgiving, and you're thinking, okay, I got to do the Thanksgiving food. And you probably have already thought this out if you invited people over. You've probably been thinking what your menu looks like. But John has some neat things to offer here. Why don't we start with the stuffing?
Okay.
And go right through your list.
All right. Well,
because you've written so much about the Chesapeake, I'm not surprised that your stuffing involves oysters.
It has to, you like a little bit of oysters in it. It's pretty typical. There's two ways to go with it. You can go with the stale white bread, the toasted white bread. Then you do your saute, a little bit of onions and carrots and celery, maybe some garlic. Saute that, get it nice and limp.
You're sauteing in butter?
In butter, yeah. And then put it in with the bread. The bread cubes, and you just toss in it together and then put a little salt and pepper. Then towards the end, after I make that part, I'll take like a pint of oysters and take about half of them and I chop them up. Then I fold that into the bread mixture, and then I leave some of the other ones a little bit coarse, you know, maybe cut them into half or to quarter, depending on the size, and then put that in there as well. Toss that into the mixture as well.
So you don't chop them too much because you don't want to lose the idea of the oyster in that stuffing, right?
Exactly. You know, some of it you want just in there for taste. Some you want for texture. And then I always make sure to save the oyster liquor that's in the thing. And then I kind of just drizzle it all over the bread cubes. Give a little bit more flavor. It's like the super concentrated oyster stock. I mean, it's unbelievable. Then toss that together. Now, some of my friends will pour a little bacon grease in there. Other people will just take some chopped bacon and toss it in. I don't usually do that, but many people will do it. And I have other friends that do it. Same thing we just said, but instead of using the white bread crouton, they'll use a cornbread crouton. And so you got an oyster cornbread stuffing. So you go any way that you want to. You're still just doing the same process.
Question for you. Does that go inside the turkey or is that a standalone stuffing?
Well, as I don't want to be hauled away by the Food and Drug Administration, I have to tell you that you should cook that in a separate pan, wrap it up nice and tight, and make sure that it's heated. Very well.
Because it's not recommended generally anymore that you stuff a turkey and roast it.
It's not, because some of the fear is that when you put it into the turkey, and especially a raw turkey, and you pack it tightly, as it roasts, it creates a perfect temperature for bacteria to grow in there, and often it doesn't get hot enough in the center of the stuffing to kill the bacteria. So it's really probably a good idea to do it on the side.
And think about it for a minute. What are you gaining by cooking or roasting a turkey with the stuffing? I guess the thought is you're gaining some flavor in the stuffing, but look at what you just put into that stuffing. It doesn't need anything else.
There's plenty of flavor in this. There really is. So why take the chance? You know, it doesn't make any sense.
We'll provide a link on the podcast, in the podcast notes, to John's recipe, full recipe for the oyster stuffing. I really like the use of cornbread in that.
Yeah.
What else is on your menu? You don't have to go into each in detail, but list what's there.
We have a corn pudding. I have some maple baked sweet potato, you know, like a candied sweet potato.
That's so much better than marshmallow. What is it with marshmallow and sweet potatoes, John? What is this?
They went crazy somewhere in the 60s and 70s about these marshmallows. And, you know, for some people, it's a tradition.
It's like formstone. You know, they came to Baltimore and sold people on formstone. And sometime around the same era, I think in the 50s, they sold people on marshmallow and sweet potato.
I think they did. And it stuck with many families. Ours it never did. But
I actually don't like it. The idea of maple excites me.
Yeah.
Anything maple. Maple ice cream, maple syrup, maple coffee, maple tea, maple anything.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's really easy because you're basically making a maple syrup with some brown sugar, maple, and I grate some orange rind into it, too, and squeeze an orange into it, and then just bake the sweet potatoes in it. It's awesome.
What else is on your list?
I also have a black walnut pie. It's kind of like a pecan pie. But using the black walnuts. Now, for people that think that they're too
strong, they're not hard to get. You can get bags of black walnuts.
Yeah, especially around this time of the year, because they go rancid rather quickly because they have a high oil content. But if you're going to use them quickly or use them in a short period of time, they're great. But if you think that they're a little too strong, you could mix it, you know, like 50% regular walnuts, the English walnuts, and 50% the black. But I think it gives...
Is it similar to a pecan pie?
It is. It is. It has the same kind of consistency and stuff. So, I mean, I'm not saying replace your pumpkin pie with it. I'm saying in addition, you can have that.
I'm a mincemeat guy.
Oh,
do you like mincemeat?
Oh, that's my favorite thing in the world. And
have you ever made mincemeat, or do you always buy a jar of it?
I made it... a couple of times, and you know, it was delicious, but I think I've been using the non-such or mincemeat.
That's the one
for
I bought.
Because my grandmother Gertie used to get that, and I chase those people at the Giant down every year. And so the game is find the mincemeat. It's a great game.
You mean where it is in the store?
Yeah, and every year
you can
nobody
stump.
Knows. Yeah. And so it's the game. It's my year in the game.
You can stump the guy or the woman that stocks the shelves there by asking where the mincemeat is.
Yeah, and do you use it just as it is in the jar, or do you do anything different to it?
No, I just take it right out of the jar.
You know what I started doing a little while ago? Is I'll take two apples, and I peel them, and I dice them. I dust it just a little bit in flour just so that too much moisture doesn't come out. And then I fold that into the mincemeat. And so the pie's really high then. So you're kind of getting this apple mincemeat pie. It's really good.
That's a good idea because mincemeat pie can look sort of flat, right?
Yeah.
Very good, John.
So, and then I don't let people eat it. I mean, I let them taste a little bit of it because I save it because it's for me. For the next day and the next day because I eat it for breakfast every day. It's my favorite.
It's great, isn't it? I love it. What else is on your menu?
That was about it. We do have a recipe there for roast goose in case you aren't feeling so inclined to your turkey. But it's a little bit more, you know, it's a little bit more difficult to get the goose.
So we have all the recipes in one place.
You have the recipe, and if you're missing a recipe and you need one last minute, we got a bunch of them. It should take care of just about anything.
John, thanks very much. Things are heating up here in the kitchen. The big pot of crab soup, I can feel it on my back.
It's good, isn't it?
Actually feels good, yeah.
It does.
But thank you very much, and have a great Thanksgiving.
And same to you, Dan. Thank you.
Behind you. Hop behind me.
Hop, you hear him? Hop behind me. I'm glad he said that. So that's it. That's our show. Look for some additional information, John's menu, Thanksgiving dinner, in the notes with this podcast, episode 442. This is Dan Rodericks wishing you all a happy Thanksgiving, and we'll see you again soon for another episode of Roughly Speaking.